Yes, everybody, welcome to another episode of The Warm Down today. Delighted to be joined by David Ornstein from The Athletic.
How are you, mate? Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm good. Debut. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is, of course, sponsored by The Athletic, purely coincidentally. He didn't even know that. And if you would like to get 15%, I think it is now, off your first trial, then the link for that is in the description below. Go and check it out. There's some excellent stuff on there, including what David was writing today, which we are talking about, which is Manchester United have done what?
They were the lead item in this week's column. And I think with good reason, because it's a good story. It's a positive story for Manchester United. The whole context doesn't necessarily reflect completely well on what's been going on there in recent years, but it is a move in the right direction. And I think United fans should be quite optimistic about what it represents. I don't want to get into the politics of Man United and you know, Ed Woodward. Is he a disaster for Man United? Is he the right person for Man United? The Glazers, etc. But on a micro level, what we're saying in this piece is that Manchester United are in the process of enhancing their behind-the-scenes operation, specifically when it comes to data analytics.
In recruitment, that was as well.
And it covers recruitment, it covers the academy, it covers the medical side of things. Now, a couple of things it's important to point out. Manchester United do a lot around data. They do analysis, but this is quite different to that. Firstly, it's not analysis, it's analytics. So it's the deep use of data. It's about creating algorithms themselves. It's about not just using data. Manchester United have a company, I think it's called Drip Lab and various others, where they access the data, they study it. They can't be criticized in that sense. They've got scouts all over the world. They're bringing reports and numbers and data in like you wouldn't believe. But it's how you use it. And this data analytics drive, which you can go back to things like Moneyball. You can go back to, you know, things that were pioneered and are being pioneered by Liverpool and Manchester City. The Premier League is far ahead of the likes of Spain, Italy, even Germany, who do it in a slightly different way. Their data analytics is more video-based and focused on the matches themselves.
So it's more like what Brentford and Midtjylland were doing.
Exactly. Leicester are doing it now as well. Brendan Rodgers has appointed their first head of analytics. But Liverpool and, sorry to mention them on this podcast, I can feel your pain. they're really leading the way on this with City and others. A guy called Ian Graham, who is said to be phenomenal. He works very closely with Michael Edwards, the sporting director, and they both have a very harmonious relationship with Jurgen Klopp. It works pretty seamlessly. Ian Graham asks for the rawest of data you can imagine. And I know you do a bit of work around analytics, so you would know what I'm talking about. He asks for the X and Y coordinates, literally where players were on the pitch at any given time. And he then decides how he's going to interpret that data, creates processes and structures and strategies, and with his team and the likes of Michael Edwards, they make their data most applicable for what they want to see at Liverpool, what they think is important, where they want to be going, where they want to improve, and it is tailor-made for them. That is what Manchester United are now hoping to do. So they are in the process of recruiting, as we know it, over a course of time. It's not going to happen immediately. Eight people, headed up by a head of analytics, headhunter.
That's a lot of people for analysis.
It is, and they've already got people working on an analysis, so it's not entirely new, but this particular function or remit is a real step up. So eight people with a head of analytics, data scientists, which they haven't had so much before, and yeah, as I said, working across recruitment, medical, and the academy. essentially, if we get rid of all the fluff that I've just talked about, it's about making more of the right decisions, less errors in all of those areas, and maximizing their ability to do everything they can, leave no stone unturned behind the scenes, off the field, and hopefully that will start to translate to on-field results. Unfortunately for United fans, your club has been behind the curve.
Even Moy said that when
on this front, yeah. And I think that's pretty surprising of a club of Manchester United's stature and calibre. And it doesn't really matter what I think. People I speak to in the analytics world and in the football world point out that United have been behind the curve, and they've got a lot of ground to make up. But this move is seen as a step in the right direction by people I really respect. It is seen as being good for the data analytics world and good for Manchester United. But the ground they have to make up is pretty significant. That said, there are many clubs who don't do it. We're talking the likes of West Ham and Crystal Palace. They take a slightly different approach. Arsenal have dabbled with analytics and are still using it to an extent, but now maybe taking a more contact and relationships-based approach, which we saw in the January transfer window, probably combining the two. Chelsea have a great scouting operation. I'm not quite sure how their data analytics works, but Manchester United, we've seen so many stories over the last few years about them recruiting a huge number of scouts. Ed Woodward admitting that some of the recruitment has not been up to scratch. Well, whether you like him or it or not, they are taking steps that they should have been taking a while ago, and hopefully for United it will pay off.
I wonder if this goes back to having Sir Alex Ferguson at the club for so long and the job essentially grew around him. And he was essentially a director of football, wasn't he? He had the power, and the signings that we made so often was, if you listen to some of the things the players were saying, was Sir Alex Ferguson phoned me up and I'm not saying no. And I wonder if that was our recruitment strategy, was Fergie would call you up. And when you actually look at it with a critical eye, that might explain why we had probably like 50% success rate with transfers. I look at what City and Liverpool are doing, and obviously I'm not going to enjoy the football or the team or what they're doing, but when you look at how they're run as football clubs, you have to say that they're both run quite well. And I think Jürgen's had pretty decent success with his transfers. City, I think, by and large, have had some pretty decent success with transfers of late. And you don't see them hopping around from one strategy to the next, which you see with United, which I think has been a huge issue. People like Daley Blind, if it wasn't for the Mourinho era, would probably still be a United player and probably first choice still, I imagine.
Well, on Blind specifically, there are many who have watched him play that would argue that he maybe should still be at a club like United, because and that United was the problem and not him, with a lot of change at that particular point in time. And interestingly, he's got a relatively low buyout clause at Ajax. And I think there are a number of clubs, despite this issue with his heart that he's come back from, who are looking around for him now in England and other countries as a potential summer recruit. Back to your wider point. It's clear Manchester United were a bit of a victim of their own success under Ferguson. Behind the scenes, they didn't adapt at the speed that other clubs were adapting. Arsenal fell a bit of a victim to this as well under Arsene Wenger. The benefit for Arsenal was that they had the Manchester United template of the Ferguson-Moyes transition as a way of guarding against complacency and not being set up properly for a transition after such a long period of time with one manager in charge. And so they did put a bit of a structure in place, and what their model shows is that even that doesn't guarantee success, because it was very difficult for Unai Emery, and it's proving so for Mikel Arteta now. I'm not an expert in these areas, but I do speak to people who are, and it's clear that Sir Alex Ferguson was the best director of football that anyone could have had at that point in time, that era. We're not saying he would have been right for now, but as you quite rightly point out, he occupied that role in conjunction with David Gill. You could say these days that there are too many cooks, and actually it's not as complex as it needs to be, and that they showed that. But you're right, there was a mixed success rate, certainly some hits and misses. I think it's pretty clear now, it's been you know, argued by so many people and far more intelligent people than me, that United, their first and most important appointment post-Ferguson should have been a director of football. I still have this conversation with people at United and elsewhere all the time. I do not understand why they haven't appointed a really experienced, quality, proven European world director of football.
Yeah, why did we seem to go for... Because I know for a fact Rio Ferdinand and Evra were both touted for the job by Ed Woodward. I know that he asked both of them to do that job and he's been turned down by both of those. I know that.
Yeah, well, those names you mention within the football world, so again, not giving my personal preference, would be laughed at for that particular role. I'm not underestimating...
The only attraction they've got is the commercial and value that they've got, yeah, and as ambassadorial roles.
Exactly.
But they're not Paul Mitchell.
No.
Contact Central.
Exactly. So somebody said to me the other day that if United do eventually make this appointment and they go for somebody like Rio Ferdinand, they're in trouble. Give him some role, perhaps, but not director of football. Maybe he would admit that himself. Ooh. Go for Paul Mitchell type person and you're in business. Now, United, when I say it's an absolute no-brainer, they would have a different argument, of course. They would say that they've got the right business people in place with Ed Woodward, Matt Judge, Richard Arnold, and they've got the right football people in place. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, Mick Court, chief scout whose name escapes me.
Marcel
Boot, and also the longtime chief scout, Jim Lawler. But my preference would be a director of football, without a shadow of a doubt, who can put a clear strategy in place that can leave Ed Woodward to the more commercial side and doing what he says he does in transfers, which is sign off the financials. Reports suggest that he does more than that, but I'm not privy exactly to that.
Depending on whether it's a success or not.
Successful or not, yeah. United believe deeply in Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's vision. We've talked many times about how the recruitment works from around September time. They plan towards the following summer. If they can do deals in January, they do. They admitted Odi Ighalo was outside of that plan. So they are backing Solskjaer. I hear sort of from people who they're speaking to do with transfers and various other things behind the scenes. And when I speak to people in and around United as well, that's really genuine. They are fully behind Solskjaer. Now, there are thoughts about certain coaches, managers, if something was to change, but that is sensible for any club. I think they would regard Maurizio Pochettino very highly. I think they would regard Thomas Tuchel very highly. But they are squarely behind Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. So that comes back to the director of football point. What do you do? And it's a very delicate situation. I'm not saying it's easy, because you can undermine a manager. Do you bring someone in that he wants? Do you bring someone in who has no relation to him? It could go wrong. We saw Monchi go to Roma and he was said to be the best sporting director in the world, and it went terribly wrong. And he's gone back to Sevilla. Arsenal tried to get him. We don't know that would have worked out. Edu came in, somebody that Arsenal know well, and Unai Emery knew well.
He's got a reputation.
He's got a reputation, but he's never been a sporting director in Europe. We don't know how well that's going so far. It's still early days. So it's not a fine science. The other thing I would say, crucially on this analytics point, is that you could take two schools of thought. One person said to me that these appointments are gradually edging United towards the ultimate appointment of a sporting director, technical director, director of football.
Yeah, technical director seems to be the phrase United want to use.
Yeah. And then somebody else in the same field said to me, that's absolutely not the case. And if it is, then they're onto a mistake. Because if you appoint eight people in the analytics department and then you bring in a technical director, it's akin to signing all your players and then appointing the manager rather than appointing the manager and then getting his players in. So that second school of thought would point towards Ed Woodward remaining in charge, and the current hierarchy. It's a bit unfair to pin it all on him. The current hierarchy remaining in charge and bringing in these specialists, analytics, medical, footballing, call it what you like, and having a bit of a dilution of his power and influence, but he remains the consistent kingpin, the link to the Glazers, and without needing to bring in that one person, the technical director, to bring it all together. That would be that second school of thought, and possibly that is the way. My personal preference, get a top technical director.
Go get Paul Mitchell. Even though I believe he might be a Blue, but... I believe there's talk that he's a City fan, but no one's perfect, I guess.
I don't know. He's worked at what, Southampton and at Tottenham.
MK Dons.
Yeah, so no professional link to Man City so far. So I think you could stump
him. He's from around here, though, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah, he is, actually. So you need to do some investing. Or maybe I do.
I think he's a Blue, is what I'm hearing. But I've got no issue with him whatsoever. If he comes and does the job he's done elsewhere, then it'd be a brilliant appointment. I'm hearing a little bit of a whisper that Mike Phelan is doing this role in all but title at United at the moment.
I don't know about that. I've seen loads of reports to suggest that, because wasn't he in the mix to be... there was one suggestion that he was going to be interviewed for this role when the names such as Ferdinand were floating around. I've heard Antero Henrique, who was at PSG. Some people say to me, don't go near him.
Is that the guy who Clive Oak came out and said he's a businessman, not a footballman?
I think that rings a bell. And also some of the things that went on at Porto, where he was, and at PSG, suggest that I think he's probably not the right man for Manchester United. And it's an incredibly important decision whichever way it goes, because United really do need to... all clubs are saying this, but especially a club of United's expectations. They need to cut out some of these errors and start working in a way that is appropriate for a club of their expectations and of this year. You know, in 2020 and United with dominant force, we know things are cyclical, but there's no reason with United's financial clout and reputation, global appeal, etc., that they shouldn't be at the very, very top end. No recruitment is perfect. You know, Liverpool used deep analytics and data largely to convince themselves about Naby Keita, and I don't think he's been a success yet, despite, you know, clear potential there if he stays fit. There was one example that a couple of people said to me, actually, that shows how United's processes aren't quite right. This is a subjective opinion, right? United would probably argue it in the other direction. But Aaron Wan-Bissaka, in ordinary circumstances, and certainly I think the United under Sir Alex Ferguson, although not guaranteed, would have gone to an intermediary club, and I don't want to label these clubs intermediary, just to be clear, but a sort of stepping stone, whether it be a Newcastle or an Everton, before working his way to Manchester United, because Aaron Wan-Bissaka at Crystal Palace was a defensive player required to defend most of the time, with not a great emphasis on attacking. At Manchester United, it's traditionally the polar opposite. Attack, attack, attack. And so how is Aaron Wan-Bissaka going to adapt immediately from defensive play to attack? It was a very rapid rise. He'd only been in the first team for a year at Crystal Palace. So you go in between, say, £25 million to an Everton. You learn the art of doing both ends of the pitch. And then you make that £50 million, £60 million move, whatever it is at the time, to a Manchester United when you're the complete player. And I think that's what Manchester United, in the view of many people, should get back to.
Is that impossible to do in the Premier League era, though, when you're going to have to start negotiating for good players like maybe a Grealish or even what we've just seen with Wan-Bissaka, the 50 to 100 million sort of bracket, and there's not a lot of room for error in those transfers. You're getting two transfers because you're talking £250,000 for that.
Yeah, it's true, and it's not easy, and you know, I don't think Wan-Bissaka's done badly either. So you could argue that it was the right move. But this is just the feeling of people at clubs where it is working a little bit more smoothly. I mean, I think United had a decent summer with three British signings who have, on the whole, worked out pretty well when you impartially analyse transfers at other clubs as well. It's very easy to say, yeah, Dan James has run out of steam and Harry Maguire's had some bad games and Wan-Bissaka can't attack.
But I think Maguire's trajectory is doing that at the moment.
Yeah, I think they've been three really promising signings. Bruno Fernandes, superb so far.
It's been all right, hasn't
it? Yeah, just a bit.
Not all right,
and, you know, Odion Ighalo is gaining fans rapidly.
He doesn't need to do anything to be a success. Honestly, he doesn't.
Yeah.
He's scored one goal. Sound.
It's a free hit. Yeah. And, well, it's quite an expensive free hit, but it's a shot to nothing in a way. And those are players that want to be there. And so I can name you clubs where recruitment has been far worse. The one thing that I hear quite a lot is that it shouldn't have taken that long to sign Bruno Fernandes, regardless of the negotiations and the problems around that. It should have been done last summer, or it should have been done earlier
in January.
But there
was no interest last summer, was there? Or no concrete interest from United, at least?
I was told there was, and I don't know how far that interest went, but I definitely know from a couple of people that there were conversations. The more concerted interest was from Tottenham, and they were pretty gutted that that didn't develop. I think United were on the scene, but I just don't know how concrete it was in that sense. Nothing is easy or perfect. United have made mistakes. People within scouting and recruitment at other clubs report that many of the United scouts aren't happy because they're not listened to. By the hierarchy, a lot of their work comes to nothing. We hear of how many players are on databases, hundreds and thousands in some cases, which I don't think reflects particularly well. It shows how wide their net is. Manchester United are known to have the biggest scouting network in the world. If players crop up, they should really be first to view them because they've got their sort of tentacles in all parts of the planet. They're quite renowned for being good at youth level scouting and making sure they bring these names and player profiles into the system.
It's like sort of Mabry, Chong, Fosu Mensah, all of these players have come through that.
Yeah, and we saw a couple of them on Friday night against Wigan. So United should be praised for some of their work, but now it's about stepping up because when it comes to the more senior side of things, they are viewed pretty poorly across the industry. And going back to the analytics point, perhaps this is another step towards setting that record straight.
Is this another chance for United to get some good deals in? The Kantes, the Mahrez, those rough diamonds that you just discover? Because it feels like United don't want to take a risk on those, although Dan James could be one of those. Is this a move towards United uncovering our own rather than... I mean, I don't want to see United spend 100 million on every transfer. It'd be great to find a couple of our own Mahrez and Kantes out of nowhere, players like that.
Yeah, they're not getting good value in a way that some other clubs are. Minamino to Liverpool is quite a good example, but even
Haaland with what he's just gone to Dortmund.
Haaland, yeah, I mean, I've got to say, and we all get different opinions and we're not always right, but the most recent thing I heard from somebody who's got really good connections at Dortmund is that Haaland was never going to be coming to United this January window just gone by his choice. I know people around United who...
United were very confident that was the opposite.
Thought he was almost in the building. I mean, yeah. I reported that he had been seen at Carrington and that some United staff thought that it was basically a done deal. They were just waiting for it to be announced. I've heard that from Haaland's perspective, he was never going to come to United. Now, if he listened and he's got a good relationship with Solskjaer and they weighed things up, his dad, Alf Inger and the boy himself, then maybe that's fair enough. That's due diligence. But as recently as I know it, his plan, which was very clear from a young age with his father, was that we go to the Bundesliga first and then we make the move across, whether it's Manchester United, Real Madrid, Barcelona, or whatever. Now, that doesn't mean things always work out as you plan. Maybe the Dortmund deal might not have been right, and
perhaps it hasn't got off to the best of starts, though, has it, Dave?
Rub salt in United fan wound. But perhaps what I'm saying here is a bit of a crumb of comfort that despite United making, you know, a really concerted effort to bring him in. Now, you could criticise this because you could say, if he didn't want to come, then why did you take things so far down the line? And my answer to that would be that you try and convince a player to come and it might not work out as the negotiations.
And from his side, you want to make sure that the interest is legit from Dortmund. Yeah. And there's always a playing off happens.
Yeah. And there's always a way to sort of criticise and it happens around all clubs. You know, you guys are in a bit of a bubble and a fish tank with Man United.
A frying pan, you mean.
These conversations and these the criticism and the praise and the frenzy of conversation is going on at every club. And sometimes we don't realise that when we're inside one bubble. I was told that Mino Raiola, while he was, of course, heavily involved, was more the front of this, the man to go into battle, the dog of war, the man to do the dirty work, to make the connections at the clubs, to hold the meetings. But make no mistake, what I'm told is that it's Haaland and his father who are driving this. And I'd be really intrigued to see if it does end up playing out, as we've been told, a stop at Dortmund and then on.
Be weird if a lifelong City and Leeds fan whose dreams to watch Leeds win the Premier League rocks up at Old Trafford and bags, because I think he'll score a couple of goals if he come, looking at how he's gone so far.
There's a fair chance. But back to your original point of finding some gems. Look, the game now is about value and unearthing these talents for as low a fee as you can and developing. Maybe I say the game now, that's probably always been the case, but with this analytics and this ability to scour and do due diligence like never before. So, yeah, Dan James is an interesting example, because there is a chance that can go on to be seen as a really good value deal. The way the season's panned out, there's a risk it was a slight overpay at the time, but perhaps...
I think he's been just rushed in to playing more minutes, more starts than I think anyone ever really expected from him, because of the injuries and because of how paper thin the squad was.
Yeah, I think Maguire was an overpay, but I don't think that means it's not a good player to have.
That is another thing where I think a director of football might come in, where I think if I see Paul Mitchell sitting there negotiating a deal and he says, I'm going to pay you this, and he goes, well, we want 100. He goes, oh, fuck off, he's worth this much.
Yeah.
I see Paul Mitchell having the authority to know and be respected for knowing how much someone's worth is working at all the levels he's worked at.
You raise a crucial point. Knowing the market is absolutely imperative. And I'm not sure United will say they know the market inside out. I'm not sure others would agree with that. And there was somebody high up in recruitment that I spoke to recently, and he said United always end up paying whatever it will take in the end. And everyone in everyone in meetings with United about a potential signing know that they will cave, was the word I was told. They'll cave at the end. Now, I'm not underestimating Matt Judge and his negotiating skills, but they caved on Aaron Wan-Bissaka. They caved on Bruno Fernandes, although there'll be some debate about whether they...
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that in a second. How did we get him so cheap?
Well, come back to that, but they caved on...
Harry
Maguire. And cave is maybe a harsh word. I'm using a word that was told to me, but they will always pay it. And so on your original point, I don't know if we're going to see United plucking gems. It would appear they've got some brilliant talent coming through, and they're trying to, in terms of some of the clubs that they've fended off, to acquire a couple of young boys that I've heard about. I would suggest that they're maybe focusing more on winning at that younger level than necessarily winning the sort of intelligence battle first team level. On Bruno Fernandes, I don't really know the ins and outs of it. And it was I was told it was a bit dubious going into that final week. But then you don't know what tactics are at play here. whether the media are used to kind of play United's hand in a certain way.
With the Barcelona interest for 20 minutes, whatever it was.
That one I was told was untrue, but then you don't know if you're being told it's not looking good, whether it really is, but that's quite a nice distraction tactic, or if it's looking good. There's so many sort of political machinations that go on in these situations. I think that will be seen to be quite a good deal. And the only thing I can think, and this is not an educated view, is that ultimately it was known in the game that Sporting needed to sell. And so Bruno would have pushed. United clearly felt that this was now finally the time to do it. Mm. And the early indications suggest that, my goodness, when you're seeing defenders going for £85 million and talk of Koulibaly for over £100 million, then bringing Bruno in for whatever it ended up as and his performances so far may see that to be a steal.
Which might lead us to a good negotiating point when we go and speak to Aston Villa at the end of the season. Because if they go, we want 100, will we go, well, I don't know if you met this Portuguese fella that we got for 45. I think his value is probably more down at that end.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting with Grealish because, you know, the suggestions have been around Grealish and Maddison, mainly for that sort of midfield.
I don't understand bringing both of those in, to be honest.
No, I mean, I think, could be wrong here, but it's about going for both and seeing what you come out with. Both slightly similar profiles and positions, etc. I think Maddison will be far tougher because Leicester could well qualify for the Champions League. Manchester United might not, even if they both do. Leicester are in a really strong position contractually. He's only, you know, a year and a half in from joining from Norwich on a long-term
deal.
Signed
an extension a couple of months ago, was it, as well?
He's not signed an extension.
Was he not?
No, and that's one to watch out for. I think it's very close, and Leicester are hopeful, but it's not done yet. I could see him signing an extension with Leicester, and then, I'm just predicting here, maybe then in 18 months' time, we're having this same sort of conversation again, because it would appear his stock is only going to rise, and that would probably suit everyone. He proves himself to the likes of Manchester United that he's a consistent performer at the top level. He develops more personally and professionally. Leicester get maximum value for him yet again. They're brilliant sellers, Leicester. They're great at managing contractual situations. So that's a tougher one to pull off this summer. However, Grealish will want to leave Aston Villa, not because he's desperate to leave the badge. He's Villa through and through and loves the club, but to move his career on. If Villa are relegated, it's a no-brainer. And I think, as a guess, you'd be looking at maybe 40, 50 million pounds for a relegated club?
Very happy
club.
With that. Very happy.
If they stay in the Premier League, then Villa are in a strong position to, demand 90?
I'm sorry, listed.
80, 90. So that's going to be a fascinating situation. Prediction would be that that's more likely than James Maddison.
I agree.
But it won't be the only name on Manchester United's radar for the summer.
Before we talk about him, I think it's going to go like this. Try and get the deal done today, like literally before 5 o'clock, right? Because I think every time you leave this, if he gets an England call up, 10 mil. If they stay up, 10 mil. If he plays in the Euros, extra 10 mil. If he scores or gets a man of the match or he has a stand-up performance, now you're talking about 80, 100 million.
Yeah.
And I think if you could just do the deal now, is he a player that we want? Seemingly.
Yeah.
So let's get it done. I mean, I was told he was United's first choice back in December or something like that.
Yeah, that's a good theory. And if everything worked that simply, all clubs would do it. Chelsea moved quickly for Hakim Ziyech and got that done. But, you know, they're linked with Ben Chilwell and they can't get that done quickly because nobody knows where Chelsea and Leicester are going to finish. Man City are said to be interested as well. Both of those clubs would need to shift a left back. Would it be Benjamin Mendy at City? Would it be Marcus Alonso and or Emerson at Chelsea? So United's different with these midfielders because there are places available for them. But then again, you think back to Pogba. What's going to happen there?
I think we all know.
Yeah.
I don't know where.
But do they need to make sure that's done before they commit the resource to these guys?
Sounds like it.
Yeah, so it's a really good theory. Why don't you get it done now? I think it would be easier with Grealish, but then there's the relegation sort of situation. Will they, won't they go down? Much harder with Maddison. It's all well and good saying strike that deal now. Mm. But Leicester, that's going to take a long negotiation if that's going to happen. Does the player want to negotiate now?
Well, and if Leicester just don't want to entertain a negotiation,
then you can't do that deal now. And that's why I think Aston Villa would be easier in theory. It's interesting, like in Germany, you see these deals happening in January for the summer. It's commonplace. And some people in recruitment that I spoke to around the Ziyech deal said here in the Premier League, a lot of us were quite shocked that they managed to do that so efficiently, so early for the summer, because England is normally a reactive. You all move together. So the German clubs, when one signs ahead of the summer, it starts a chain reaction. It creates a vacancy that needs to be filled. So when Bayern move, then Dortmund move, then Leverkusen move, and so on. Whereas England, nobody moves, and they all scramble around at the end of the window.
And Sky Sports make loads.
And they make loads of money, and it keeps us talking too.
On everybody moving like that, I follow rugby league quite closely as well, and there's a really interesting phenomenon in rugby league, which is the most frustrating thing in the world, which is players are mostly on one-year contracts because clubs are so tightly run. Most run at about a slight loss, and there's so little money in the game that people on these one-year deals, they've got to start finding a club halfway through the season. And you see every single club has announced 5 signings, 6 signings for next season before this season's even finished. And Salford, obviously my local team, lost the guy who ended up being the Man of Steel, the Player of the Year award, ahead of the grand final. And we all knew by the time he was going to the grand final, he was leaving. And speaking to some of the lads who he was away on Great Britain tour with, it was like he tried to reverse that transfer after getting so far with Salford, but was unable to do it. And you just think, this is a mad market. Like, half of the players involved deep into the meaty end of the season know they're probably not going to be there next season. And I just think it's a terribly run thing.
It is. And especially in England, there's a lot of pride at stake. There are a lot of egos in these boardrooms, and negotiations seem unnecessarily chaotic and unprofessional at times. I don't understand why these Premier League clubs are just not more efficient and it's really hard for us to say that, actually, because when we don't quite understand all the intricacies. So we're only going on what we're seeing. The rugby league example is superb, and in certain other countries, stuff gets done far better.
Is it just the sheer value of the transfers? Because we've seen, like, Salford City have signed probably 60 players in the last 18 months, something along those lines. Because the value is just insignificant in the grand scheme of things. You can rotate in and out with little drama, but if you're trying to move on a Pogba or perhaps even a David De Gea, maybe.
And that almost brings it into like the draft system in US sports. And the money is clearly a key factor, because with so much money within the Premier League, clubs can't be held to ransom like they could before. Now, the players hold the power because they're so wealthy, they can down tools, etc. But the clubs can dig their heels in a way they probably certainly didn't before the television money really started to ramp things up. So I think the rugby league vision is ideal practice. I just don't know how plausible it is. And one of the key things I think to myself all the time is that how is an industry, Premier League football, that is so flush with money, that is so flush with intelligence, whether it be data or many of these people in these boardrooms who are leading executives, who have worked at other companies. Many of them get on with each other. If we take, I don't know, United and Palace, Ed Woodward and Steve Parrish, they know each other well. Although I think in their situation, they try and step back because of that relationship and leave it to other people. But when those other people take over, they're normally really intelligent and experienced in these worlds. I do not understand. There are some things that happen within clubs that I hear about. We report some of them. We can't report others without sort of being hauled in front of a court. But in some industries, some of what goes on in football, and in this case, England, they would break rules. They would be found guilty of like corporate incompetence and negligence. And like in the extreme circumstances, we see like a Bury or a Portsmouth.
Yeah.
And there are certain other clubs in who have been in dire situations, Bolton and some even higher up the food chain. But I sort of digress from your actual question. But I think all of this kind of mess, poor practice, lack of governance and regulation, certainly around agents and really in many parts of football, there are no rules or the rules are loosely applied, leads to a bit of a Wild West where negotiations take too long, people ask for too much, there are too many people involved, too many interested parties, too much pride and ego at stake. Just when you think you've got a deal, somebody gets greedy and asks for more money. And that denies you the chance to do what you do in rugby league and see these trades bang, 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 done, done.
I don't think it's a good thing necessarily in rugby. I think it's a negative thing.
No, I know, but it would give us a bit more clarity. There's also this like huge wars with in public, the PR around these football transfers is so much more sensitive and delicate than in rugby league and other sports, where even the slightest change going from initial talks, preliminary talks, advanced talks, close to an agreement, an agreement has been reached, still need to finalise paperwork, complete the medical, travel. Oh, but there could be late interest from so-and-so. Troy Parrott not being able to leave Tottenham at the last minute because of a UEFA regulation. Like there are so many little details and the sort of public, the way it plays out so publicly spooks a lot of these people as well. And situations get left to fester. Also, clubs not being properly set up. The Premier League has this really glossy image. And
I was just about to say, do you think there's an assumption of competence where there isn't any?
In many cases, yeah. And I know that for sure. The Premier League, when you work in the media, and you will have experienced it as well from your positions, there's this image in the Premier League that, and it's partly accurate, and it's certainly been sort of polished by the broadcaster Sky and BT and marketed all over the world as being this all singing, all dancing, perfect league. Whereas some of us get to see what goes on behind the scenes. Even in visual form, when you're at stadiums and training grounds and things and speaking to people and you're like, God, that's not the image that people are seeing around the world. And lots of what you hear in conversations and phone calls and things, it really does stun you. Much of it is very unpleasant. And therefore, when clubs are not set up properly and don't have the people in the right positions, or if they do, they're not necessarily competent in their roles, or they're taking on too much work. I've heard of players who are just sitting waiting and representatives for phone calls to come back to them because the man or woman who is responsible for the negotiations and the contracts and the money are too busy with other players, dealing with too many loan deals, away on a different trip, and players are left twiddling their thumbs. Many don't get the move. And I mean, pieces probably have been done and even more can be done. There are legions of players out there who are sitting doing nothing that didn't get moved. Umar Nias at Everton, you know, he was again close to a move out. He's meant to be a really...
Damian at United was on the verge of a move for about seven windows, I think.
And what is it like for these players? I mean, they pick up their paycheck, they go in and train. Nias is said to train really well, be a really good guy, very professional. You just train and go home and you sort of partner and children.
Are we moving to another country tomorrow?
Don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Don't know. And I'm a footballer. My kids never see me play, but I go in and train and I pick up my paycheck and we have a nice... It's a very, very weird, wonderful, strange, depressing, concerning industry. But we keep coming back.
Right, before we go, because I'm conscious of the time.
Jadon
Sancho, what's happening?
Well, Jadon Sancho is clearly going to be the one of the main stories of the summer, because he'll be leaving Borussia Dortmund.
It's only the 2nd of March.
It's only the 2nd of March. And if I remember correctly, I reported in May 2019, live, I think it was on Radio 5 Live on the BBC, that Manchester United's number one preference for the summer transfer window, if it would have been possible, would have been Jadon Sancho. And if Sancho was to move back to the Premier League that summer, or in the future, that his preference at that point in time would have been Manchester United. We know things don't work out necessarily that smoothly. A January move was reported in various places, but never from my perspective. It was always the plan that he was to move in the summer. So he had interest, or has interest, from... he could move wherever he wants, but most prominently from, and in no order, Real Madrid and Barcelona in Spain, and then in England, Manchester United, Liverpool, Manchester City asking to be kept abreast of the situation. I reported this a while ago. This is not necessarily up-to-date information, and no contact at that point in time from Chelsea. So really a four of the two Spanish clubs, Manchester United and Liverpool.
Yeah, I think there's as much chance of me playing for City as there is Sancho.
Well, you say that. But grudges get dropped in football, and I'm not saying it will happen, by the way, just to be clear.
Yeah, they do if they put 250 grand a week on a table.
There are circumstances that can change these situations, and some players might have a preference to set the record straight, and a player might feel they have unfinished business in the way that Sancho left Manchester City, and if the numbers work, then you never know. I would say that's less likely than Manchester United and Liverpool. And Liverpool's feeling has been that, you know, that sort of money that's going to be demanded, whatever it is, in excess of £100 million, is not what they're going to be looking for at this point in time, because
God, so much money.
You need to be bringing that sort of player in to be guaranteed first choice for that sort of money. And Liverpool can't do that at the moment because of their front three. Things change very quickly. One of the hardest skills in recruitment or club management is to know when to sell. Is it time for Liverpool to sell one of those three in the summer? Who knows? It's not looking that way at the moment, despite what the Watford match may have suggested.
I did enjoy that.
And so I think they... I'm sure. I think there is, of course, admiration for Jadon Sancho at Liverpool. Whether the timings are going to quite work out. I was always told that the Sancho or Mbappe type signing would have been Liverpool's style one step earlier, when they were a little bit cheaper, a little bit less known, and then Jurgen Klopp molds them into the superstars. But maybe in this case, it will be the next step rather than, you know, this summer, and whether those players will be available at that next step is possibly unlikely. Manchester United really want to sign Sancho. Ed Woodward's very keen on it. It's delicate because we don't know if United are going to be playing in the Champions League next season. We don't know if that is a prerequisite of Sancho. Most people would say, of course, he needs to be playing in the Champions League, but we don't know. You know, he could make that move on the hope that within one season, he's only a young boy. How old is he now?
20, I think.
20. So he within one season,
21 this year,
21, 22, he could be playing in the Champions League at Manchester United. You would assume that they'll be prepared to pay the transfer fee and the salary, which will be extremely high. He's on a very good deal at Borussia Dortmund, and there will be some clubs who will be put off by that salary. But as one of the foremost young players in world football, he will command it. He will get it. Chelsea's an interesting one because he's from London. He's got friends there, and it would seem to be a bit of a glove fit. But the indications are that it's not for Chelsea, Jadon Sancho. Whether that's around money, whether that's around a similar United Champions League uncertainty, or whether it's around a more important factor that United don't necessarily have, and that's a saturation of wing players already. So
necessarily. No.
I don't want. It's not for me to make judgments on your squad. But Ziyech at Chelsea coming in the summer. On his name, the young English winger.
Hudson-Odoi.
Callum Hudson-Odoi. So for some reason, that's not emerged quite like the other interest. Look, you can't hold me to this, but
you know what they're gonna.
Yeah, as things stand, I think Manchester United are looking the most likely option. but so much can change. Very boring answer. I don't think that the intense negotiations are taking place just yet. They'll start to hot up now that the January transfer window. And by that, before people say you can't negotiate with a player, you know, who's under contract, it's possible to express interest and make it known what you'd be prepared to do in an informal way that isn't tapping up, isn't an illegal approach.
But isn't this why agents exist as well?
Yeah, like, exactly.
You represent X player, me and you have a conversation.
Yeah.
I've not necessarily directed it straight at Sancho, but...
And it happens every day in football. I don't think those conversations wanted to be entertained by Sancho and his camp leading up to January. I think they do want to and need to entertain them post-January. But I think with so many of these deals, the likes of Grealish, Madison, others, Chilwell, deals across all clubs will really start to hot up in April time. Mm. And then, bang, the deals need to be done because there's a Euros.
Yeah, the Euros.
Though there is a longer transfer window.
Yeah, thank God they got rid of that.
Well, you say that, but it... You know, some people that would have wanted to be going on holiday towards the end of August now can't because
the Maldives will wait, mate.
Yeah, the bringing it forward was ludicrous. The moment that other countries didn't follow suit, you knew it was going to be put back to the end of summer.
David, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. It's been awesome.
Go and check out the Ornstein and Chapman podcast over on Athletics, over on iTunes. You can go and listen to it. It's good. I listened in the car this morning on the way in.
Thank you. You didn't have to say that.
Well, I do, though. I listen to that, the Zonal Marking one and the Talking Devils one. They're all pretty good. Madness launching about 114 podcasts on the same day. But...
Yeah, and there's probably more to come, but...
And if you want to check out some of the writing from David and some of the others that cover not just United but all the football teams around the world, actually there's a right horde of writers that you've got, isn't there?
There are. There are too many than too few.
True that. In the description, that's theathletic.co.uk/Howson, and you can get all sorts of bonuses for doing that. Right, David, thank you very much.
Thank you, mate.
Make sure to subscribe, get your questions, comments and abuse in the bottom, and I'll see you in the next one. Laters.